You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer from The Nation magazine, Dave Zirin, on the politics, sports. Meanwhile, Joe Biden declares unconditional exit of all U.S. forces from Afghanistan by September 11th, 2021. Curfews imposed in Minneapolis suburbs in the wake of the Dante Wright killing. Capitol Police had advance warning about the Capitol attack, but apparently were told by their supervisors to hold back and refrain from using most effective methods for stopping said attack. Today saw a historic committee vote on H.R. 40, a reparations bill. It was held in the House today. Meanwhile, Matt Gaetz associate cooperating with DOJ. Let's call this Pizza Gaetz, folks. Senate to possibly advance a bipartisan anti-Asian hate crime bill. Canada overtakes the U.S. in new COVID cases for the first time. Legislation to regulate PFAS, those forever chemicals in our drinking water, has been reintroduced in the House and may have an opportunity to pass this time in the Senate. Joe Biden will advance a Trump-era sale of F-35s and drones to the UAE. And lastly, according to the head of the IRS, tax cheats cost us $1 trillion per year. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us, joining me and all of us. As always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, hello. How are you?
Hello. I am doing well, Sam. How are you?
I am doing well. Hanging in there, dealing with like this weird thing that's happening with my hair today.
Well, you put too much coconut oil in it.
I think that's we could debate about that later. I don't know.
Happened.
Yeah, something yeah. happened to it. Something
I know
happened
a little
to
bit
it.
About it.
A couple of things I wanted to just know. First off, I should say, credit where credit's due. The Pizza Gaetz moniker I got from the blog Eschaton. That's Atreos over there. People should be reading that blog on a daily basis. And we should also say that story about the IRS, and we're going to talk about this in the fun half of the program, but the story about the IRS chief testifying yesterday, I think it was, in the Senate, that we as a country are losing $1 trillion. A year. It's an estimate, but he laid out the reasons for that estimate, the basis of it. I'm not one of those people who are terribly worried about the deficit or the debt. There's very little reason to believe that the deficit or debt has really any bearing on our economic activity. Inflation is possible, but you tax. But in an era where we still have Democrats, and I guess Republicans to some extent, who are constantly obsessing about the idea of paying for, how are we going to pay for this? Well, there's $1 trillion sitting there on the table. For people who have their taxes automatically deducted, you're a wage earner. The rate in which those taxes are paid relative to unpaid taxes is something like 99%. For people who, for really essentially the very wealthy who make their money through capital gains or through pass-through corporations, the IRS estimates that there's 20% that go unpaid taxes. Here is a clip of that moment in the Senate yesterday. I think it's important to highlight this. This is clip number 11, I believe it is. This is the IRS commissioner in the Senate Finance Committee.
Published tax gap estimate of the Internal Revenue Service, the current one that's out, and we'll be issuing one next year, but the published tax gap estimate is for tax years 2011 to 2013, has a gross tax gap of $441 billion. As you indicated, Mr. Chair, in 2011, folks were generally unaware of the term cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and all. There's more than 8,600 cryptocurrencies, virtual currencies in the marketplace, and the market cap worldwide for cryptocurrencies is almost $2 trillion. Our tax gap map for 2011 to 2013 is based on information that is from 2011 to 2013. It does not include any focus with respect to virtual currencies, which I indicated now is about a $2 trillion market cap. It does not include much information with respect to foreign source income. It does not include information with respect to illegal source income, which is still taxable and we do chase. And it also, more recently, within the last 2 weeks, there was a report published that included two IRS researchers from our RAS organization that indicated that the top 1% of all taxpayers by high income account for as much as an additional $175 billion in the tax gap computations. And that's associated with their look at only two issues, which were pass-through entities and offshore income associated with the top 1%. If you aggregate the points that I'm talking about and you look at the fact that there's a current estimate by folks on the outside that the tax gap is $7.5 trillion over the next 10 years, and you add in the component pieces that I've referenced, there are more. I've just referenced the ones that are most highly visible at this point. If you add those in, I think it would not be outlandish to believe that the actual tax gap could approach and possibly exceed $1 trillion per year.
So that's like more than double what the official estimate was. Is that correct?
Well, he's adding up all these things. I mean, that is, I believe it is. But the bottom line is there's a tremendous amount of money sitting on the table. And we have cut, over the past 10 years, 17,000 enforcement-related employees. 17,000. And we have known for certainly as long as I've been talking into a microphone about politics, that for every dollar you spend on the IRS budget in terms of enforcement, you get four in return. There is, I guess, maybe short of Bitcoin at this point, there is no better return on investment, certainly not for the U.S. government, but even in any area. 99% of taxes are paid to the IRS when there is automatic withholding and reporting to the agency, but only 45% of what's owed gets paid when those do not exist, when there is not automatic withholding and automatic reporting. I mean, that's
almost
just
like the government works when they actually choose to enforce these things.
Well, I mean, the problem is that we don't, the amount of money that you need to spend to come chasing this, you need some money, but we have had at the very least the Republican Party and to some extent the Democratic Party have systemically defunded the IRS. And the benefits have all accrued to those people, essentially, well, certainly the top 1%. But I would just say, broadly speaking, rich people in general in this country.
And Redding hinted at the next frontier of tax dodging, which is crypto.
Exactly.
So, I mean, Rob Portman apparently going to introduce some sort of legislation in the Senate to combat this. I find it dubious as to whether that will go anywhere if the filibuster remains in place, but at least he can signal, and you know, crypto's more for young tech bros. So, but that is, I mean, the word's going to spread. This is going to be a way for rich people to hide their money.
It's going to be interesting too. If I would be curious as to how the president parliamentarian would rule on such a thing. I mean, if you have the IRS saying, look, we can't give you specific numbers, but we can give you broad estimates as to how much we are losing in tax revenue because of the regulations around cryptocurrency. One could argue that this has a direct impact on the budget of the United States. And so that would be interesting to see if that's something that could be rolled into reconciliation.
I registered president parliamentarian like 5 seconds too late, but good. Ah, I mean, you stole my joke, but good.
That's all right. That's all right. That's no problem. I put it in the footnotes of the show.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Zirin. He is the host of the podcast Edge of Sports. He's also the Nation Magazine sports editor, author of the upcoming book, The Kaepernick Effect: Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Take a quick break. We'll be right back. And, one of today's sponsors also happened to sponsor my breakfast this morning. Well, actually, they didn't really technically sponsor it. They provided it. I went on a binge. Did you see, I bought like 8 boxes of the cinnamon in the office? I don't know.
I saw, that's been my go-to at my place. So I can't snack on the cinnamon here when I have it for breakfast. I'll overdo it.
Are you now eating the cinnamon?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were more like, I can't remember what flavor you had.
Frosted. I like peanut butter. I like fruity and I like the cinnamon. So I got all 4.
We should probably say what the name of the product is. Of course, we're talking about Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon has the flavors that you love, but here's the good part. Well, here's the other good part. It's without all the bad stuff. You don't have to give up eating cereal to be healthier. Zero sugar. Zero sugar. 13 to 14 grams protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Only 140 calories a serving. It's keto friendly. It's gluten free. It's grain free. It's soy free. It's low carb and it's GMO free. And here's exciting news for you blueberry lovers. Magic Spoon is relaunching the blueberry flavor. It's one of your favorite flavors back in stock now after being sold out. Or here's what you could do. You could build your own box. Available flavors to build your very own custom bundle are cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, and cinnamon. I think they have a couple of new flavors as well. I think I saw peanut butter and jelly, which sounded pretty interesting to me. But I mean, here's the bottom line. The cereal is fantastic, and it doesn't have that crap in it. Not only is it healthier for you as an adult, but the thing I also love about it, my kids love it. I had to stock up on the cookies and cream. I think that was one of their, you know, they rotate the flavors through. And Saul loves that cookies and cream, but he's also a big fruity fan. So I keep both in the house. And it is a pleasure to be able to get your kid to eat something that's not full of sugar. And of course, I eat it really largely throughout the morning. I have maybe a bowl in the morning, or sometimes I just graze on it when I'm at work. You can too. You will not be disappointed. You go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport to grab some blueberry or a custom bundle of cereal to try it today. And be sure to use our promo code majorityreport at checkout save $5 off your order. This offer is now good anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, but only when you use our code at checkout. Majority Report. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Use the code MAJORITYREPORT to save $5 off. Folks, Mother's Day is coming up. Now, I know this is going to sound a little weird, but I have a very, very unique idea for what you could give as a gift this year. Emma, think about it. You're looking for the perfect Mother's Day gift. You ready? A bidet. Yes, a bidet from Hello Tushy. You can bring your mom into the future with a brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. Come on. Look, first of all, it's stylish. It's eco-friendly, super easy to install. Will help stop flushing, your folks' retirement down the toilet and toilet paper expenses. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself before and after it's used with a smart spray automatic cleaning nozzle. When they say anyone can put this together, they mean even your parents. It's super easy. It attaches to your existing toilet. It requires no electricity, no additional plumbing, no tech support, no FaceTime, none of that. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If your mom already has a Hello Tushy, you can upgrade to the 3.0.
You're not washing your butt enough.
Well, I mean, honestly, it is not, I will say this, it is not the traditional Mother's Day gift, but I'm telling you, it is never too late to revolutionize your life. And this is the way that, it happens. Trust me, folks, it is a revelation. It makes so much more sense. It's just that we grew up without it. And there you go. This would be a great gift. Your mom would have never, ever contemplated a gift like this. And then, of course, it's also the gift, really the rest of the family, too. You can give a gift of a clean butt right now by going to hellotushy.com/majority. You get 10% off plus free shipping. Special offer for our listeners, hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. All right. I want to welcome back to the program one of my favorite guests. He is the host of the podcast Edge of Sports. He is the nation's magazine sports editor. He is the author of the upcoming book, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Dave Zirin, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. How are you? Thanks for coming.
Hey, doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
You got a Tenacious D shirt on. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
The Mighty Mighty D. I've seen them live probably more than any other band.
Wow. That's pretty good.
Which is actually much cooler than it sounds, I swear.
No, they're cool. Like, Jack Black, he's aged well in terms of just his contributions to society, in my view.
Oh, I remember seeing those guys when they got together back in the day, way, way back. Before they started touring. Anyways, Dave, that's not what we're here for, but we can catch up on that. I want to talk about, there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about. I want to talk about the piece that you wrote, relative to MLB leaving, for their, the All-Star game and the cancellation of the Twins game the other night. We're going to talk about the Olympics and what's happening with the NCAA at the Supreme Court. And but let's start with the reason why I grouped together the baseball and what happened at the Twins is you made the point that Major League Baseball, these teams have a relationship to the community. And they're getting involved in politics in some level it feels a little bit different than typical corporate structure.
Oh, Definitely, definitely. I mean, we have to look at sports history during times where there have been crises like this. Like in 1992, you had the L.A. Rebellion after the officers were acquitted in the beating of Rodney King. You didn't see any teams do anything. You didn't see any athletes say anything. And that is the norm when you have these crises in different cities. I mean, 1968, after the riots when Dr. King was assassinated, you had teams actually, like, the most they did was get on the radio, players, and say, people, please return to your homes. So actually acting as an agent to try to calm people down, not try to organize people, not try to get their voices heard. And I think we are living in a profoundly different moment at this moment, where teams feel like they are not only a part of their community, but if teams don't get out front and say things, then their players will. And their players will then put teams in the position of, and when I say teams, I'm really saying executives, franchise owners. Right. They're operating from the rear. And they don't want to do that at this point. I think all these teams were caught flat-footed last August after the police shooting of Jacob Blake, when athletes in the NBA, WNBA, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer, when they all made the move to withdraw their labor and say, we're not going to play. And the teams were sort of caught flat-footed at that moment. And I think teams now are determined to be out front and say, you know what, we stand with our players, we stand with the community, and we understand that this isn't a moment where we could just do games as usual.
I mean, it is sort of fascinating to me, the idea that the players are now leveraging their power as labor, with management, and then management, because there's a different relationship than, I mean, look, ultimately these guys are just, you know, they're trying to suck up as much dollars as they can, and they're willing to sort of chew up stuff in the way, but because the players are leveraging their power here, the relationship that these owners have to a specific community, you can actually see. It seems to me to be possible on some level that, like, you know, Minnesota Twins could have could influence, you know, what Minneapolis does in terms of what's in the portfolio of police there.
Oh, absolutely. The impact is strong. And, you know, we could talk about and tease out the reasons for this. I mean, baseball, the average age of the baseball fan is 57, and they live in this existential fear that in 20, 30 years, baseball is going to be a minor sport on the landscape. So they're trying to get an audience that's under 20 years old. And then they have asked themselves, what does this young generation want? And they understand, I've interviewed some of these folks who are trying to do this marketing to younger fans. They understand that this fan base is more demographically diverse than any generational fan base in this country's history. And they're more intolerant of intolerance than any generation in the history of this country. And they need to figure out how this young fan base, a fan base that, by the way, people are competing for their eyeballs across social media, across 1,000 channels, across 1,000 streaming services, how do we connect and get their eyeballs? And they understand that if they don't have some semblance of a social conscience, or even worse, if they're seen as being prehistoric, Neanderthal, antediluvian, in other words, if they resemble Brian Kemp, they know that they're going to have no kind of an audience coming up in that younger generation. So it's connected with the power of players, their desire to get a new audience, and the desire of their own sponsors. And we've seen this across the landscape since the police murder of George Floyd, their own sponsors who also want to look like they are on the side of social justice and not on the side of the people doing the killing.
Can you talk about how, you know, it's like I think about back in history about notable athlete activists like Muhammad Ali or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But for every one of those, there were hundreds more of, like, O.J. Simpson. He was a star, but he was notably very anti-political and, you know, and was a favorable person to corporate America, et cetera. Like, there was no institutional support behind these aberrations of players who were talented enough to speak out and not fear retribution by the team or lose sponsorships and still, you know, still have wealth. They were only able to leverage their power based on their star power, but even most stars, they didn't speak out at all. Then I see the post Kaepernick era. And then there's the post George Floyd era where it took another step. Are those notable benchmarks in in how players have begun to leverage their power? Because that, to me, those seem like good ways to look at it.
You know, I'm smiling a little bit when you ask the question, not just because it's a very, very good question. That doesn't cause me to smile, because that's expected. What's making me smile is thinking about the journey that Colin Kaepernick has taken, and that he's somebody who's been exiled from his sport, and yet we see it as a step forward for the empowerment of athletes. And it's worth teasing that out for a second. Like, how is it somebody who is ruthlessly punished for daring to stand up, how has that somehow improved the political and power position of athletes themselves? And I think it's simply because that you've had this mass movement surround what Kaepernick did, of what's happening off the field and off the court, that has somehow burnished his reputation to the point where they have been unable to bury him. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Mass marches in the street, the power of social media and athletes being able to be heard around the media and around the institutional structures of their team itself. But I think what's also so important about 2021 is we have to remember that Kaepernick took his knee almost 5 years ago. And so this young generation of athletes, whether they're in college, and I know we're going to talk about the NCAA, or whether they're in their early 20s, they have grown up basically from ages like 16 to 21, thinking of Colin Kaepernick as a hero, thinking that he was correct, thinking that what he did was brave, and thinking that they need to find themselves in a position where they're building on his sacrifice. So I think that was a huge benchmark. And you saw that reflect itself in the George Floyd protests as well, because you saw so many people, I think, taking a knee during the protests. You saw in some cities police officers taking a knee to show that they were on the side of the protesters. And I think a lot of that is very performative. Right. You have to put it mildly, but it shows like the power of what he did. You even had Roger Goodell say, "We owe Colin Kaepernick a debt of gratitude." I mean, it's unbelievable that they're this shameless, but it shows the vindication and the power of social movements, because that's what's the difference between a Colin Kaepernick and, say, a Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who in 1996 didn't come out for the anthem to protest U.S. foreign policy and got buried for it. He became a ghost story by which people would say to new generations of players, "Hey, you don't want to end up like Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf." And I think that's what they wanted for Colin Kaepernick, to be able to say to this new generation of players, "Don't be like him or you'll find yourself out of the league," when instead he's become kind of an animating spirit for this young generation of players.
So let me just get back a little bit to the question. So the players are able to leverage this with their owners. Is there any mechanism that the players have? Because look, you know, they're players. It's not, you know, they're not politicians. They don't have time to sit down and, you know, work this stuff out and sort of measure. But is there any type of, like, are they contemplating, I don't know if it's through the union or whatever, some type of like institutional support? Because, you know, there are some people who say that MLB should not have left Atlanta, that the wrong people are being hurt by this. You know, in Atlanta, you know, I don't know how to assess that necessarily, but instead what the players should do is like demand all of the owners, you stop contributing to Brian Kemp, you stop contributing to any of these legislatures in Atlanta, in Georgia, or whatever. I mean, is there a mechanism where they can, the players can hold the owners to account in some way other than just, "Hey, I took a knee at my corporate party, and so we're good," you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that you mentioned the unions. It's hard to see the unions institutionally holding ownership's feet to the fire in terms of donations to political parties and the like. I think it's going to have to be players organizing themselves independently of the union, because I don't see the union structured to go after the owners politically at this time. I mean, maybe that could change, but that would have to mean some serious rank and file organizing on behalf of the players themselves, because institutionally, bureaucratically, the unions are just not set up for it. I think it's the power of naming and shaming that the players have. Like, for them to look at, say, an owner of the Detroit Pistons, for example, who's making his money through investing in the criminal justice system in terms of like the phones. And this has been a big controversy up in Detroit. Like he just bleeds out people who are behind bars through their phone calls. And for them to be able to say to him, how can you have Black Lives Matter on the court? And at the same time, his name is Tom Gorris. And they're saying, like, how can you have Black Lives Matter on the court while at the same time I have this parasitic position where you're getting money every time someone makes a phone call from a prison? Like, there's a gap there. And I think by naming and shaming that, and by talking about the gap between some of the performative activism and then actually putting some teeth in it, I think that's going to be where you see the change. Now, how it organizes itself institutionally, well, they have a social justice committee in the NBA that came out of the player strikes last August. There are some organizations of players in the NFL, but those institutions are going to have to become a lot stronger if they're going to be able to go after ownership, like, on that level of politics. But already we're seeing progress. Like, I think the Minnesota teams actually canceling the games shows that they realize they can't just put out statements anymore. It can't just be performative. It can't just be, look at us, we just put end racism in the outfield or whatever. They're showing that, like, no, there are actually times where the games have to stop. And I thought it was a stirring moment and a stirring statement. And now players can take it to that next level, not to mention fans, to say, okay, you're going to cancel the games. What about canceling your contributions to some of these politicians?
Well, you talk about the strength of the institutions, right? The MLB doing this is different than the NBA doing this, right? Yeah. So say the NBA had the All-Star game in Atlanta. That would probably be a gimme, because the NBA's of the big four leagues in this country, more progressive. MLB is kind of an old school institution. And so are the players even, because, you know, you look at your talk about the strength of players' unions. To me, from the outside looking in and just being a fan of sports, you know, what has always sapped some of these players' unions from the real power that they hold is the fact that these careers are so finite. Exactly. And so they don't necessarily, they can't hold the picket line in the same way other unions may be able to, because they're like, I have to capitalize on this maybe 4-year career, make as much money as I possibly can. I can't afford to take a year off, do a labor stoppage, et cetera. Like, what is the difference in terms of the leagues that you're seeing, you know, around the country, the institutional pushback by, say, the MLB versus the NBA, and then how the strength of these unions relate to those institutions?
Well, it's interesting. I think the unions are playing catch up, because the MLB, one of the main reasons why they moved the All-Star game from Georgia to Denver, there are a lot of reasons. We've already talked about some of them, corporate pressure and the like. But one of the big reasons was about what happened last August and players expressing their labor power by refusing to play. And I think that's something that was a buildup that was just beginning before MLB said they were going to move the game out of Georgia, of players, managers, the union speaking out and saying boycott is on the table for this particular game. And so Major League Baseball, what they did was actually head off a boycott, I would argue, by moving it to Denver. So people who say, oh, losing so much money, it's like, how much money would have been lost if the game basically had to be canceled? Or if they were working with third tier all-stars and all the like of it, or just finding anybody who would be willing to scab on the game if players were willing to boycott. So I think what players have done is actually frighten ownership. The events of last August haven't been discussed nearly enough, because you haven't seen, like, for the reasons you said, you haven't seen strikes in recent years. And one of those reasons is, the number one reason is what you said, the length of playing careers. The other reason is that salaries are flush. I mean, players are doing well, even though there's fear about the future financial viability of some of these sports leagues because of an aging fan base. They also have locked in these huge television deals. So financially, that's good. But then if you have players expressing themselves as workers on social justice questions, I mean, striking against racism, striking for Black lives, I think that's what these main sports leagues, especially as fans are going back in the stadiums, are trying to figure out how they can work with and how they can navigate this new world with the players and not in opposition to the players. Now, is that something that's going to keep going? I don't know.
Let me just ask one more second. This is breaking now. Officer Kim Potter will be charged with second degree manslaughter for the killing of Dante Wright. Maximum penalty is 10 years and or fine. When we talk about these different leagues, and I know Emma's going to move to the NCAA in a second, but is baseball of the four big sports like the – or maybe not, I mean, as I say it, but are they – where are they positioned relative to the – speaking to that younger audience? Relative to, let's say, I mean, obviously NBA, you know, is far more in touch, I think, with young people, but I mean, I just, you know, I'm coaching my kids, minor league, you know, pony league team. And I can see the level of interest is not what it was when I was a kid.
I mean, it's
slower. The game is slow for them.
Mm-hmm. And it's slower than it was a generation ago. I mean, I just interviewed Dave Parker, one of my heroes growing up, great Pittsburgh Pirate, the Cobra, Dave Parker. And he's told me that he has trouble watching the game that he grew up loving, that made him famous. You know, he just wrote a book about his life, and he has trouble watching games in 2021. They're longer than they were a generation ago. And right now, Theo Epstein, one of the smartest baseball minds arguably ever, this is his full-time job, is trying to figure out how to market the game to younger fans, how to make the game shorter, how to make sure it's not 4 hours long, how to make sure that people like my son, who loves to play baseball but doesn't love to watch baseball, how do you bridge that gap where they actually want to watch the game? Because at times it can feel unwatchable. And I think baseball has always been very conservative when it comes to figuring out how to change their sport. They're very conservative in general, institutionally, which is what made them moving the All-Star game, I would argue, such a crisis for the GOP. Like this idea, like, you, I mean, they've tried to paint Major League Baseball as if it's controlled by a quote-unquote woke mob. The GOP's Twitter feed put out something that implied strongly that baseball was in a communist conspiracy with China and Cuba.
Not the PGA Tour, but not the PGA Tour. They're still good American, red-blooded Americans.
For the GOP.
Yeah.
They've got the PGA Tour and attacking trans kids and stopping people from voting. That's the big three plank of what they're standing on right now. And they're adrift because of it. And I think the idea that they're losing baseball, it presents a social crisis for the GOP for the simple reason that, like, what is so noxious about them that even an institution this conservative is saying, yeah, we want no part with what you're doing to the country.
So much of what surrounds conversations about race in sports, you know, is indelibly connected to their labor and labor rights. And, you know, that's what we're seeing with the NCAA I think even much more exploitative level, because at least the players in these leagues are getting paid and they can in good faith negotiate with the league that employs them. The NCAA, we've talked about this, Dave, before, but they, in my view, engage in incredibly exploitative practices as they rake in hundreds of millions of dollars, and their coaches get paid millions of dollars for football, basketball, March Madness just happened. That rakes in millions upon millions for TV networks and for the universities. Players get $0. And now the Supreme Court is taking up this case as a labor issue. Mm-hmm. The NCAA is trying to argue that this is an amateur sport, and so it should be treated as such. But the fact that the coaches get paid millions of dollars kind of flies in the face of the amateurishness, right? It should be just the mechanic coming off the road and then in his spare time coaching the football team. But I digress. What is your sense of how this fight with the Supreme Court is playing out?
Oh, I mean, I followed it very closely. And what was so striking was that even the right-wing rump of the court, we're talking Thomas, Kavanaugh, Alito, they looked at what the NCAA was arguing and they recoiled, which is not an uncommon thing that I've seen. Like, people who are on the right who just don't know how the business operates and don't realize how, frankly, how it's this unconstitutional labor space that's been carved out just for these so-called quote unquote student athletes, that they look at it and they're in shock that such a situation exists where coaches make millions of dollars, players make bupkis. And I think they received quite a shock to see no defenders on the Supreme Court, and particularly this right-wing edge of the Supreme Court saying, yeah, this doesn't seem like a fair labor practice at all. What and asking questions that you and I have been talking about for a long time and that longtime watchers have been saying for decades and decades. Like, they're acting like this is the first time they've ever thought of it, where they say things like, well, what happens? Where's the education come in? Like, why? Like, this is the questions the Supreme Court justices were asking. Like, why can't they take the classes that they want to take? Are they really getting an education for what they do on the sporting field? And so I think if I'm the NCAA, I'm feeling more pressured than ever, and more thinking more and more that their time operating in this certain business practice is over. And they've been corrupted by the sheer billions that have come into the sport. You know, a statistic I always throw at people that I think is great for bar conversations is, you know, Dabo Swinney, coach at Clemson, makes $10 million a year with bonuses coaching at Clemson. Danny Ford wins the national championship for Clemson in football in 1981. He made 50 grand. So how does a job that pays 50 grand in 1981 pay $10 million in 2021? That's about a change in the very basis of the sport. The very economic base has been utterly flush with money, and it's raised questions for the athletes themselves when they see assistant coaches making millions of dollars a year.
And, well, and they could blow out their knee and they could never see professional success and never make any money, and their jersey number could still be sold and they're not making money off of that either. I mean, without their name on the back, I guess, by the university, but still, I mean, Sam, I'll let you go, but it's just, it's, I want to get into how indelibly the racist, the old Southern racism component plays into this, but Sam, you can go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious as to what the answer is. I mean, obviously the, you know, one answer is they need to be paid commensurate with, you know, there needs to be, you know, they need to be paid because they're, what they're doing is not fundamentally is not amateur right. sports. But the other, I mean, solution, it seems to me, is to go back to that era where the head coach gets $50,000, right? Like, I mean, I don't know if it's possible to turn the clock back like that, but and maybe, you know, I mean, it's just, it seems the whole thing seems like even paying them, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't be paid, but like the idea of colleges having this sort of like cottage industry, which is really not really a cottage industry in some of these places, right? It's like, it's almost like the college is built around, you know, we have people go to classes so that we can actually justify having the football team and generate this exactly. revenue. Like, maybe there should be like, I mean, or is it that you make it so onerous to pay the athletes that all there needs to be some type of like relationship between the profits generated and what is paid to the student athletes so that there's a rebalancing of what the whole enterprise is about?
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of things in what you said, like, I don't know if we can turn back on what the coaches are getting paid precisely because so many these contracts are signed for the next 10, 20 years, and they amount to billions and billions of dollars. So all we can really play with realistically is how that money gets allocated. And a lot of these coaches are under contract. So thinking about how to make sure the players are able to get a piece of the pie of something like an $8.8 billion NCAA contract, for example, I think is the only tangible way forward. Because if I had a magic wand, what I would do is just de-link our system of higher education from minor league sports altogether. You know, get the NBA to pay for its own minor league, which they're starting to take steps towards doing. Get the NFL to pay for its own training system to get this generation of players who are good enough to play, who want to play, sign them up. That's what other sports do. And it's no coincidence to me, and this goes to what Emma was inferring a couple minutes ago. It's no coincidence to me that the sports that depend on the universities to provide this kind of free labor and free training, these are the sports that center Black American athletes, football and basketball, because they're the most disempowered coming up through the youth sports system. So they're most easy to exploit. and that they're done through our university system is kind of disgusting. And that sports have become like a neoliberal tentpole of the entire economics of not just the universities, but these small university towns, right. South Bend, Indiana, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I mean, South Bend, where Notre Dame is, a century ago, Notre Dame's a small private college that has a cool football team, and it's a textile community. That's 100 years ago. 100 years in the future, it's basically, it's not just a college town, it's a Notre Dame football town. And if the team does well, then the town does well. And if the team doesn't do well, then all the industries, like from hotel service industries, they suffer. That is not a good way to operate. And that also answers the question, though, about why football players at the start of this horrific pandemic were deemed essential workers. Because they were while students are staying home doing the work, the players are putting themselves at terrible risk of what at the time was a pandemic we knew very, very little about. And they were being put to work. That's a problem.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of this, too, is that the NFL and the NBA are complicit in this exploitation. And the dirty secret is that the NBA and the NFL unions are complicit in a little of this exploitation in many ways, because they uphold these contracts between the league and the universities and the NCAA that says, if you want to come to the NFL, you've got to play 3 years of college football. You're not going to get paid. Mm-hmm. You could ruin your knee. You could blow out. You can make millions for the university. You could be a star player. And the families that have been betting on you, say a lot of these kids come from poor backgrounds, and they're banking on making millions of dollars in the league for a short period of time in order to help out their families. You know, you'll never see that. And I mean, what's your take on that? I could rant about that forever, but like, because of that contract between the NCAA and the major leagues, this is why the system of exploitation and racism is still in place.
But the hidden joy in all of that, like a lot of dirty secrets, but there's a hidden joy in there. And that's that these players are really disempowered, but they also have a tremendous amount of power at the same time. They're disempowered because they don't have a union. They have no way to collectively bargain their health. They have no way to even collectively complain about their situation without risking losing their scholarship. But they also have so much power in that if they chose to withdraw their labor, say before the Final Four, they would be able to rewrite their relationship with power and with money with a snap of the fingers. And we've seen inklings of this in recent years. And there were even rumors going into this year's Final Four that players were going to refuse to come out and play unless certain changes were made in the structure. It didn't happen, unfortunately. But I've never heard the rumors so live as I did this year, as players are doing hashtag not NC, no NCAA property and putting out, using social media to shine the truth on what was going on. Because, you know, injustice thrives in shadows. And the best thing about social media, and there's so much awful about it, but the best thing about it is that you can shine light on whatever you want to shine light upon. And a lot of players have been taking advantage of that in recent years, oftentimes defying the social media rules that are set down by coaches, which can be ridiculously dictatorial.
I for one would love to see that development where there's, you know, minor leagues for football and for, I mean, I don't know how, you know, what the future of football should really be, frankly, but these minor leagues for basketball, so that this onus, so that you're able to sort of like de-emphasize these sports programs in the context of these colleges. It just doesn't seem.
It's become a religion, though, for town, Sam. It's just not a realistic way to go.
I know that. I mean, it's so disturbing, the idea that the fortunes of these towns are so intertwined with a multi-million dollar football program. It's just sort of disturbing, I think, on some level. But
then you get these incredibly bizarre scenes, like last summer. After the killing of George Floyd, you see a march in Tuscaloosa, Alabama of the football players. You see a march at the University of Mississippi of the football players, where they're joined by their white coaches to march in the town against racism and police brutality. Now, have these coaches all of a sudden become born again social justice activists? Not at all. But they understand that their players have so much power in these communities. And the fact that they're small towns actually gives the players more leverage than if, say, the big college programs were in like Philadelphia, New York City. It gives them a degree of leverage that I think over the next few years, we're going to see them leverage even more.
All right. I want to turn to the Olympics. I think probably everything I learned or the vast majority of what I learned that's bad about the Olympics, I did by reading your book on the Rio Games, and we spoke about Sochi, and this came up, and I know I want to talk about, you know, Echo Park and what that says about the LA Games, but first, you know, it came up the other, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and someone was like, you know, they're going to play the Tokyo Olympics, but there's going to be no fans that right. are going to be there. And I mean, give me your perspective on that, because I was like, oh, wait, is that good? Because I like the games. I just don't like what the games as an institution, what they do to those cities that they're in. And yeah. I would imagine a big part of that is because they're basically using this as a one-off, you know, major tourist attraction that is functioning at the same way as like almost like, disaster capitalism does. Yeah. It's just, you know, a shock to the system. We come in and this is the way we're going to sort of reorient things. What, give me your take on the Tokyo and then we'll talk about LA.
That's a sporting shock doctrine. Over 70% of the people of Tokyo don't want the Olympics there. They think it's going to be a super spreader event, that the vaccination rate is incredibly low in Tokyo and in Japan as a whole. They've done an amazing job controlling the pandemic because of people willing to wear masks. But as far as like vaccinations, terrible. And they don't want the games because where the games go, you get debt displacement and the militarization of public space. And I was in Tokyo right before everything shut down because of COVID, and you saw it there. You saw those fears. I spoke to people who'd been pushed out of their homes. I spoke to this one family that was thrown out of their homes for these Olympics, and they also had been thrown out of their homes in 1964 for the last Tokyo Olympics. Oh. So this is a family. So I'm speaking to this woman with of course a translator, this woman in her 70s, who's talking to me about being thrown out of her home as a small child. And then again, like being thrown out of her home for these Olympics as well. So people in Tokyo are not happy. There were protests when I was there, but the Olympics, they feel like they're too big to fail. And they feel like they've got billions of dollars. The Japanese government has invested billions of dollars. And so the show must go on because they have to satisfy NBC. They have to satisfy the television rights for this. And if they get the games on television, it doesn't really matter if fans go or not.
Right. That's where all the revenue is generated. What of the idea of, and we should talk about LA, but the story is the same, isn't it? I mean, in every place it is. Yeah. It is how we're going to dispossess people of their homes, and we're going to sort of subsume public property and make it private. And it's really just like, this is our urban renewal project, but it's for just wealthy people, essentially, going forward. How's that playing out in LA?
Well, just one last thing about how it's playing out in Tokyo is that they've themed it as the recovery games and using Fukushima as a backdrop, where they're going to be doing the running of the torch through Fukushima, where there was, of course, natural disasters that led to a nuclear, a brutal nuclear fallout. I visited Fukushima. I visited it with scientists who had those machines whose names I'm forgetting that detect how much nuclear waste is in the area. I mean, it's still a nuclearized zone, and they're going to be doing events in Fukushima, all to spread this idea that recovery games, and who knows what the theme is going to be for LA, but I promise you, we're going to be talking about LA for the next 8 years. I mean, or 7 years. Not just when the Olympics are about to start in 2028, because there are already huge protests in LA. There are already city council people in LA who are actually pushing back against the logic of Olympism, which means more police. It means more surveillance. LA is already one of the most heavily surveilled cities in the world. LA has a, absolutely terrible homelessness problem, which is going to be exacerbated by the Olympics. That's what the Echo Park battle was really about. And that's also why a lot of anti-Olympic activists, they were there in Echo Park defending the unhoused people who were there, precisely because they see the connection between the Olympic buildup, which has already started, and this attack on people who are at the absolute fringes of Los Angeles.
We should just tell people that Echo Park is a neighborhood in L.A. There's a park there that had been, basically rehabbed over the past. I can't remember how many years ago it was. I read at one point, like they found a car in the pond, a couple of cars in the pond there. It was cleaned up. And it during the course of COVID, it has become basically a small community for unhoused people. The different people have different perspectives on, you know, whether that's a good thing or there, but they went in and cleared it with a lot of police violence. Mm-hmm. With temporary housing for these unhoused people, but it's really just not doing anything. I mean, it's just basically it's like hitting the reset button again, mm-hmm. but you're destroying a community that had been keeping people safe. Yeah. In the process. So there's no direct bearing there. It's just
similar set of issues. The big three are debt, displacement, and militarization. And in Echo Park, you see the displacement and you see the militarization. And that's what has people on edge in LA. And you're going to see so much in the next 7 years. You're going to see figures in LA who you've respected in the movies and sports world talk about how great it is that the Olympics are coming. You're going to see protests in the streets by interesting actors, like people you might not necessarily think of as a protesting community, like the unhoused people, for example. You're going to see a lot of that in the next 7 years. And I think we should brace ourselves for it, because I think the veil has really been lifted off of what the Olympics are. This isn't the 1984 Olympics anymore, with Ronald Reagan coming out in Los Angeles and everybody cheering the fact that the Soviets are boycotting the games and Carl Lewis wins 4 gold medals. Like, those days are done. There's so much more dissent now.
Why can't we just like find a place where they are permanent? I mean, wouldn't that be the solution here?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't know. There's got to, you know, some I don't know
some
what country.
Plot of land, build it.
Honestly, yeah. Like, you know, and that's the permanent Olympic. Is the reason why we don't do that because people think like, oh, it's not fair? Or is it because this is such a, you know, I don't want to overuse the word, but like neoliberal project here, and that that like there's just too much money. I mean, look, the TV people would still be able to get their pay, you know, would still be able to make their revenue, right? It's just that this is used. Is it just that the people who are in charge of the Olympics use this as a way of like enriching certain groups of people, narrow groups of people around the world, and everybody gets a taste? Or is that why?
I mean, it makes so much more sense. And I've been arguing this for years. You find one consistent location to have the games, no matter where they might be, call it Greece, you know, why not? And what's good about that is you don't create what are known as white elephants. Those are stadiums that get used once and then are just left to rot. These stadiums, these facilities could actually have use value with every Olympic Games, and you could make sure that they're rebuilt and rebuilt well, and you create jobs that are actually consistent because you need to keep making sure that upkeep is good. Like that makes so much more sense than what they do is creating this kind of travel log as if this is the late 19th century. And we're all supposed to be like, ooh, look at Tokyo, land of magic in the Far East. Like, we don't know what Tokyo looks like. But the reason why they do it is exactly the reason that you're saying. And John Carlos, the 1968 Olympian who raised his fist, he once said to me, the reason why they have the Olympics only every 4 years is that it takes 4 years to count all the money. And that goes to what you're saying, whether you're talking about commercial sponsorship, whether you're talking about the global anti-terror weapon industrial complex, which is a real thing, like that these companies that go around the world and they sell themselves to mega events like the Olympics to say, we are the best institution for you to bring in for billions of dollars so we can surveil people. And guess what? You can actually keep the equipment, the closed circuit TVs and the rest of it after the Olympics are done. So when Olympics leave a place, the places themselves are actually less democratic than when they're there in the first place. And what's so ironic is that the Olympics, the IOC, they argue, well, the reason why we have to go to places like Beijing is we make Beijing more democratic. We make Beijing more like the West, when the opposite is the case. They make the West more authoritarian.
Well, Dave Zirin, always a pleasure. Folks, check out Edge of Sports or Dave's writing in The Nation magazine. Can't tell you how much. And looking forward to your book, The Kaepernick Effect, coming out, I think, in the fall, right?
Yep, this September.
Great. All right, Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both.
All right, quick break. We'll be right back to wrap it up. All right, folks, that's it for us. And so when you see people protesting the Olympics in L.A. Or in Tokyo, for that matter, now you know why, because it is going to lead to a tremendous amount of hardship and displacement for people. And it's going to fundamentally change the structure of the places that you're living to the detriment of a lot of people who live there. And there you have it. That's why you always get a lot of pushback on when people are trying to, you know, win that that Olympics lottery. But that's it for us. Emma and I will be back tomorrow. And or back now.
Oh, we never left. Back like we never left.
Folks, stick with us for the fun half. Brandon Sutton's going to be joining us today. Just want to remind you, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and you get a free of commercials. You can check out our sponsors if you are a member. You can still check out the deals that we have for our sponsors. You could check it out with Hello Tushy today and Magic Spoon. I get texts from people who are like, what's the fast growing trees coupon code? And you can always, like, if you Google the company and the Majority Report, you will find it. So check it out. Join the majorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. And also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Get 10% off. Joining us in the fun half will be Brandon Sutton. Brandon, why don't you tell folks what's happening on the discourse?
Well, on the discourse, we're all getting vaccinated in the exact frequency that makes it impossible to record, because we know we're coming down with that sort of post-COVID vaccination muscle ache. So can't lift the microphone quite yet. But coming up on the discourse, you know, we're streaming more on Twitch, and we should have an episode out by the end of today.
Oh, I see. All right. So you guys, everybody got vaccinated around there. Group vaccination for the show.
We all hold hands, you know.
Might be solvable with a mic stand.
Well, that's a good idea.
Do you Twitch video games, Brandon, or are you guys chatting?
No, we Twitch stream video games. I'm not much of a gamer. I'm kind of old fashioned in that way. I don't believe in it. But
what do you mean you don't believe in it?
I don't believe in it. I don't know how to be more explicit than that.
You don't think they exist?
You know, I believe they corrupt your soul. They corrupt your spirit. But, you know, I'm down for that sometimes. It helps. No, but, you know, I, as somebody who's not very tech savvy, had to order a special hookup to be able to stream my PS5 to the internet, because that beyond me otherwise. So look out for that. So we're going to be streaming some games, probably PS2 games from the last time, you know, I was good at it. So look forward.
All right. And Matt, what is happening on the in the Matt Lekian media empire?
Yeah, we have Laura and Jim on to talk about the Reclaim Idaho documentary on the Medicaid expansion there. And also Cale Brooks, Jacobin video editor, on to talk about his article about going from posting to politics. Kind of both interviews are going to be about that. So that will be this Thursday. Left Reckoning on YouTube. Go subscribe to it, folks.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
The song, the Lee, yes, I mean.